Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective. Due to the sensitive nature of today's topic, discretion is advised for younger listeners.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor. I'm so excited to have you with us today. And I'm very excited to be joined today by Kevin Hines. Kevin is an award-winning global speaker, best-selling author, documentary filmmaker, and suicide prevention and mental health advocate who has reached millions with his story of an unlikely survival and his strong will to live. 2 years after he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, Kevin attempted to take his life by jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge. Kevin now travels the world to share his story in the hopes of preventing more suicides and educating people about wellness. I'm very excited to have our guest with us today as we talk about his journey of being a survivor. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. So glad to be here, Graham.
Really nice to have you with us. You know, Kevin, as I start out today, I want to kind of put a caveat at the front end of our talk. Suicide is always a delicate, sometimes tricky subject to address. However, as a psychologist myself, I know, as I know you do as well, Kevin, that it is essential that we address this subject responsibly, looking to safely message it in a bold and candid way so as to name and bring to a conversation level something that so many people are struggling with and may contemplate acting on. So as we discuss Kevin's story today, folks, and the subject of suicide, I want any of you listening to our show, if you find our topic of suicide being something that you are thinking about or are struggling with or contemplating, I want to encourage you to listen to the entirety of our show, as Kevin's message is truly one of hope and some doable next steps that you can take so as not to have to act on your pain. To quote one of Kevin's sayings, he says, "Your thoughts and feelings in this moment don't have to direct your behaviors." I also want you to go grab a pen and to listen to write down some of the resources that we're going to be providing at the end. Kevin's got some great resources for us to reference at the end of our podcast, and we're also going to have those resources for you to access as well. Kevin, thank you. So, hey, as we get going today, I would love for you just to start us out by sharing with us your story.
Absolutely, Graham. Glad to. I was born in severe poverty. I had infant trauma from a very young age. In the first 9 months of my life, I was fed what my parents could steal. Kool-Aid, Coca-Cola, and sour milk was my first diet. Thus, my gut to brain health was very, very poor. And I was violently ill all through foster care. No parents wanted to keep me because I was such a sick child. I had one full-blooded brother. We bounced around from home to home in foster care. We both got a vicious strain of bronchitis and he died. So I immediately had two forms of abandonment that I had to deal with. I would later be diagnosed with severe abandonment issues and a detachment disorder at 9 months of age. But at 9 months old, I landed in the Hines home. And as you know, my last name, spoiler alert, this works out, you know, this works out just fine. Pat and Debbie Hines made me their son, gave me hope, light, and love, unconditional love from them and the extended family. They adopted and took in three kids from three separate families into one and made a melting pot of a family. Me, I'm mixed. I'm Black, Arawak, Indian, Portuguese, Jamaican, Scottish, Irish, English, and Italian. My brother's Black, my sister's white, and people were confused. You know,
I love it. Exactly.
People were confused. They'd look at us and they'd go, "What is going on over there?"
Right.
You know? I'll never forget walking with my mom as she had my brother in the stroller and my sister to her right. And I was to her left, I believe. And this pack of women across came across the street to look at the kids. And they, you could tell they were about to be like, "Oh, how cute." But they, how did that happen? You know,
exactly. Make some sense of this for us.
Yeah. And my mom just quickly replied, "Oh, you know, all different fathers."
I love it. That's classic.
That's classic. It was true, though, so they couldn't do anything about it.
There you go.
Except cross back across the street and be appalled, you know. So we got a kick out of that, but it really was some of the issues were difficult. For example, not being allowed to eat at a restaurant at night because of what we looked at as like as a family in the 1980s in California, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, growing up in the Hines home was a beautiful thing. Pat and Debbie Hines worked tirelessly for everything they ever had the hard way. Pat Hines' parents were just like my birth parents. My birth parents had substance use disorder. His birth parents had primary alcoholism and would die of liver cirrhosis, liver failure at very young ages, much like much of his family would. Of his aunts and uncles on the Ryan side, there were 9 children, 2 stillborn, 7 remained, 5 would die of liver cirrhosis, liver failure, alcoholism.
My, oh my.
And the 2 that remained, Jerry and Uncle Kevin, my great uncles, would end up, I think, being somewhere around 30 years sober. They would have all have their chips from AA.
Good for them.
And I was a kid who grew up in AA. I didn't grow up being in AA as a participant. I grew up going to the meetings with my uncles.
Yeah, as a family member.
To support them. But back to the story at hand, Pat and Debbie adopt me and my brother and my sister. We live this great life. And I think to myself, how can anything go sideways from here? And then it all does. My brain, in essence, breaks. I have a complete mental breakdown in front of 1,200 people. I go see a psychiatrist.
How old were you then, Kevin?
I was 17.
17, okay.
Right in high school.
That must have been scary.
It was very scary. I didn't know what was going on.
No way.
I couldn't control myself or my actions or my thoughts. And I just, you know, for lack of a better term, I felt like I was losing my mind.
Absolutely.
Because in essence, I was.
Yeah.
It was the first time. It wouldn't be the last. Well, 17 to 18 was a very rocky road. Lots of highs and lots of lows, because once you go up in mania from bipolar disorder, you have to crash into depression. Right. And when you go up, you go up real high and you feel like you can go anywhere, do anything, be anyone. Yeah. There were things I did that were so manic and delusional, you know, the grandiosity that I experienced. I was 17 campaigning for the presidency of the United States of America in my neighborhood, and people would just slam their doors in my face, say, okay, buddy, can you go away before we call security? You know, I'll never forget sitting in front of my porch on my father's leather armchair that I brought outside, waiting for my friend Steve to show up. And my dad comes home and he goes, Kev, what are you doing with my leather armchair in the front porch? That's not where it goes. I said, well, Dad, I'm waiting for my friend Steve. And he said, your friend Steve? I don't know this friend Steve. Who is this friend Steve? And I said, Steven Spielberg. I'm waiting for Steven Spielberg. He's about to show up and he's going to offer me the lead in his next major motion picture. And of course, my dad goes, do I need to take you to a hospital? And he probably should have.
But these are some of the warning signs that maybe when you're in them, you don't know.
You don't know.
To you, it all makes sense.
It all makes
to
sense.
You, there's nothing questionable about it.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't, you know, and it's funny when the film The Bridge came out that I did about my attempt off the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. And I told my story in that movie. My dad and I were 10 minutes featured in that film. And the film was about all the deaths at the Golden Gate Bridge and why there was nothing being done about it.
Yeah.
You know, the top suicide spot in the world at the time. After that film came out, Steven Spielberg's people reached out to write a book about my life story.
Is that right?
But my dad didn't think I was in the right state mentally to do something like that. And to be fair, I wasn't.
Got it.
I was not well at the time and they squashed it. But you know, it's a funny anecdote to go.
Yeah, it is funny.
Wishing myself in his next movie. And here he was with his people interested in my story.
But the thing you're talking about in your story, if I could just kind of tag on that.
Yeah.
You know, when someone is experiencing a mental illness, for them in that place, that's what they know. That is their reality. And the things that are going on, whether I'm going door to door for the presidency, you know, and whatever the date may be, or I'm sitting on my porch waiting for Stephen to come by. Those things are really happening.
Yeah.
And in those moments, they don't seem crazy. They don't seem off the grid. They seem like this is going to be happening. That's the internal experience, isn't it? Of what someone is experiencing, what we call kind of a delusion, a belief.
It seems completely legitimate. It seems completely plausible, most likely to happen.
That's right.
And you come to a place in your psyche where you believe that these things are real.
That's right.
And no one can tell you different.
No.
That part of the disease fascinates me, you know, the mania and what can be done inside that mania.
Yeah.
It can attune itself to a lot of creativity.
Absolutely.
Some of the greatest painters, writers, directors, filmmakers,
actors. Oh, absolutely.
Actors and the like live with and have bipolar disorder or have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Some of the greatest change makers this world has ever known have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Abraham Lincoln was one of them. You know, just fascinating stories from around the world like that. But nonetheless, I did get really sick at 19 You know, from 17 to 18, it was Rocky Road. 18, I got kicked out of my mom's house and sent to my father's house because of all the holes I was punching in the drywalls of my mom's house. Yeah. She couldn't take it anymore, which I don't blame her at all. You know, I get it. I was too much for her to bear. And I go to live with my dad, and he and I don't really get along. We're just fighting tooth and nail, arguing matches, yelling, screaming matches that should have had the police called every day. And we're just yelling at each other all day long, which was not very healthy. And then at 19, I start to have these horrible visions and thoughts that I have to take my life. I'm seeing and hearing things that nobody else can see or hear on a regular basis. It's tormenting, but I'm not telling anybody about it. I'm being completely silent in my pain, which was a huge mistake. Huge mistake to keep it to myself.
What you're talking about there, Kevin, is this idea that it can also be something that becomes very tormenting. I mean, waiting for Steven Spielberg to come by, or, you know, advocating to be the president. Those are kind of fun, playful things. That could be okay. There's part of that mania that can be, you know, creative, and we'll use the word entertaining, just be able to use it. But then there's a kind of a deeper, darker, harder side. The word you use was tormenting. It can go into that place too, can't it?
Yeah.
Very despairing.
I mean, seeing giant metallic spiders crawl across my ceiling to come down and eat me alive was not fun. Yeah. You know, seeing my ceilings open up and pterodactyls be flying overhead was not fun.
No.
You know, seeing death himself hover through my window with his scythe and blade in his right bony arm, reaching out his other bony hand, turning it upside down as his eyes light to fire in his scald face and saying, come home with me on a nightly basis, Monday through Monday, was horrific.
I believe
you. But I never told anybody. I thought I was crazy, and everyone would think I was crazy, and they wouldn't love me, care for me, that I'd be their burden. I just buried it.
Wouldn't that make sense though? But wouldn't that make sense though? Someone who has this abandonment fear, those attachment struggles, traumas early on.
Yeah.
Why in the world would you threaten a relationship with attachment and abandonment fears by telling someone what's going on inside your head? What if they think I'm crazy? What if they leave? What if I'm too much for them? Exactly. That's one of the reasons that people don't speak up, isn't it?
It really is, you know, because, you know, there comes a point to where you believe you are too much for other people to handle.
Absolutely.
And to be fair, these kinds of diagnoses can be a lot for other people around you.
Yes, it can.
It can be tormenting for them as well.
It's more so than the family can handle, isn't it? It's kind of above the family's pay grade. We need to bring in some professionals.
You do. You need to bring in professionals, and if not that, counselors of some kind. If not that, peers of some kind that know the ropes and know how to get someone to a better place mentally. You know, I still struggle, Graham. I still have every symptom my diagnosis ever started with: paranoid delusions, hallucinations, auditory and visual, mania, depression, panic attacks, anxiety attacks, heart palpitations where I feel like my heart's coming out of my chest. I still have all of that. I just know how to manage it today.
Right.
Yes, I went to the Golden Gate Bridge. Yes, I did jump off. It was the worst action of my entire life. I definitely regret it. I was saved by a few different things. A woman driving by in a red car saw me go over and called her friend in the Coast Guard. The singular reason they got there within a 3-minute window before I would set in hypothermia was because of that woman making that phone call, because she saw me go over there at the moment I went over. The next piece of it is, in the water, as I flailed to stay afloat, I kept going down. I couldn't stay above water. I was drowning. And something began to circle beneath me, bumping me up. It turned out to be a sea lion, keeping me afloat until the Coast Guard boat arrived behind me. And several people reported that to the Coast Guard that day. But a man named Morgan from Las Vegas, Nevada, actually took a picture of it and sent it to me and my father. And it's a very sad picture because it looks like a morbid, lifeless body above the water. But this, you clearly see through the circle of pictures that the sea lion is circling beneath me. It's absolutely phenomenal.
That was Herbert.
It was Herbert. Oh, you know the story. That was Herbert. Yes,
I named him Herbert. I love the story, man.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are stories of animals all around the world of all kinds saving humans in situations. There's even a story of a lion saving an infant girl from other animals. Just amazing stories. But I get to the hospital. I have shattered my back in three places. I've shattered my T12, L1, L2, missed severing my spinal cord by 2 millimeters that day. And just so lucky to exist. I'm in a bracing structure after the surgery. And my father was the first to arrive. And this is where it gets heavy, is that, you know, this is a man who I'd never seen cry in my entire life, never seen him show emotion, you know, tough Sunset Irishman, fourth generation San Franciscan, you know, the only person tougher than him was Uncle Kevin, you know what I mean? And my dad comes in and waterfalls just flow from his eyes after I say, "Dad, I'm sorry." He says, "No, Kevin, I'm sorry."
Yeah.
And for the next 4 weeks, he stayed with me in that hospital room and didn't leave one moment. I mean, on the first day when they came in to say, "Mr. Hines, visiting hours are over, you have to leave." He said, "No, I think I'll stay." And they said, "No, sir, you don't understand. These are the rules. You can't stay." And he said, "Get me a cot." And they sent two steroidal looking orderlies in that couldn't fit in the door at the same time. And they go, "Mr. Hines, we're going to have to make you leave." And he goes, "You can do one of two things right now. As I'm a third degree black belt in judo, you can get me a cot or you can get me a cot. I'm not going anywhere." And they got him a cot because they didn't know judo.
I love it.
But my mom comes in, and this is the most optimistic woman in the world, who sadly at 18 lost her optimism for me when I punched all those holes in the drywall. But here she comes in the hospital room and she says, "Well, Kevin, I guess God wanted you to win that Oscar." You know, I did high school and college theater. Mom, I did high school and college theater. I don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, thanks anyway. And she said, "Well, I wanted to put a smile on your face," which she did. So, you know.
Very cool. So this trauma had people come around you in some very, very special ways. No one abandoned you. Your message earlier was, when all these things are going on and we think, "Oh my, if people knew what I was thinking or what I'm seeing, there is no way that they could possibly stay. Either they're going to think I'm crazy or I'm going to be too much for them."
Yeah.
But part of your message here is, when we do speak up, when someone or others begin to know, or in your case, where you acted on something and they found out after the fact, people did not leave you, did they? In fact, they surrounded you.
Yeah. Grant,
that's part of your message. Grant, if you talk, people are going to be there and want to show up.
If you tell your truth, because after what I did, I got letters from hundreds of people saying, "Why didn't you call me?" Hundreds of people said, "Why didn't you call me? I would have been there for you."
Yeah.
You know, and maybe not everyone has that great support network that I would have, but certainly you've got people that would have been there for you in that moment that would have cared whether they know you that well or not. We are intrinsically human. We want to help others. It's in our nature, just like we want to survive. It's in our nature. It's instinctual. We were originally a camaraderie group of individuals. We were people that had a society that was wholly connected. Now, Graham, we live in a society that is so disconnected, so uber focused on frankly, the uberfication of life. What can I get just by pressing this on my phone right now? What can I get by swiping left or right now, whether it's groceries or companionship? We have forgotten how to exist as a culture that supports one another, no matter the pain they are in.
And that's what I think. Piece. Yeah. Yeah.
It breaks my heart, Graham.
Yeah.
To see all this, you know, I mean, like, I use my phone for work. I use it to reach people and to connect with people. And when I get messages on my YouTube channel that say people are considering suicide, I try to write back as soon as humanly possible and say, "Here are the resources you can use. This is why this channel exists. Stay here." Congruently, when someone writes to my YouTube channel and says, "Hey, Kevin, this video just saved my life," it's a light bulb goes off in my head. And I go, "Oh, my gosh, I got to keep making these videos because they're making an impact."
Yeah, you know, they are.
There's always ways to take technology and use it for good.
I love that. You're talking about what our community or what our society has done. And sadly, you're right. We've become kind of more isolative, more kind of polarized, compartmentalized and things. And our level of communication going back and forth is not what it used to be and not what it needs to be. Ideally, we begin to make that pendulum swing back to remembering that we are one larger family. We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Continuing education is both a requirement and a learning opportunity, but finding the right CE provider can be challenging. AATBS, a triad company, offers continuing education for psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, and behavior analysts. CE courses are available both individually and as part of our new All Access Pass. All Access Pass provides a library of over 250 unique courses. That's more than 800 hours of CEs, with new courses being added every month. As a special offer, Behavioral Health Today listeners can save 15% on CE purchases. Visit us at aatbs.com/BHT and enter promo code BHT15 during checkout. That's aatbs.com/bht. Check out our library and check off your CE requirements today.
You're saying, though, that in the absence of that, or in the presence of mental illness, when someone's really struggling with something that's diagnostically significant, it is hard to reach out of that fear of how are others going to respond? Or am I going to be too much for people? Are people going to be able to contain this? Am I going to chase them away, et cetera? Am I going to have another abandonment or another loss of an attachment that's important to me? On the other side, I've heard you say there's power in voices, but I know that oftentimes for probably most folks, they may be afraid to ask. And in fact, you're talking about some of the videos I watched. You were in the bus going to the bridge and you so wanted anybody just to say, hey, how you doing? That would have been it. Not this big, long, therapeutic, intro to therapy talk. Just how are you? Are you okay? That's yep. All you were hoping.
All I wanted.
And or even on the, I think even the woman you said before you jumped, she walked over to you and you said, oh, maybe this is somebody who's going to ask me. But it turns out she asked you to take her picture, if I remember right.
Yeah.
All you needed. So this is a flip side. One's the person who's in it reaching out, the other people who are on the outside looking in and just, if they see something, ask. But people have a hard time asking. Let me ask you something. If someone had asked you on the bus, hey, pal, are you okay? Or that woman who handed you the phone pulled it back and said, are you doing okay? What do you think you would have said?
I made a pact with myself. If one person says, are you okay? Is something wrong? Can I help you? Or a variation of those three, I would tell them everything and beg them to save me.
Got it.
We can help those in suicidal crisis. Even if we don't see it on their face, even if we can't even see the pain going through their face, I was just crying my eyes out. So obviously I was very visible, but there are people that aren't visible. There are people that they feel invisible internally and they're invisible outside. You don't see the affect on their faces that's changing. So to be a good neighbor then is to ask every human that question when hard times arise for all of us as a collective.
Yeah.
Are you okay? Is something wrong? Can I help you? Or even, hey, I'm worried about you and I want to ask you a very serious question, but I don't want to offend you. Are you thinking about killing yourself? Have you ever made plans to take your life? That does not put the thought in someone's mind who's not already got it. It gives that person permission to speak on their pain, and a pain shared is a pain halved.
Kevin, I want to push on this a little bit. So we sometimes when working with parents, we say, hey, you need to talk to your kids about drugs and sex. And they go, if I do that, they're going to start having sex and they're going to start doing drugs, right? No, they're not. They don't want to. In fact, it's going to be the opposite. So what you're saying here is just the same thing. Ask. But people are afraid, well, if I ask it, I'm going to insert the idea into their mind and I'm going to be the one that kind of hits that last domino that puts it into motion. Speak to that again, please.
That is a massive myth. Just like it's a myth with sex ed and drugs, talking about it is the only way to defeat it. If you don't talk about it, you'll never know if your child is suicidal. And any child, loved one, person, individual, husband, father, fiance, caregiver, anyone can become suicidal. People become suicidal because of things like trauma, mental health crises, but they're finding out it's more of just a societal woes that are causing suicidal ideation. It's less about mental health conditions and more about societal issues and woes that are causing so many people to be suicidal and to act on the suicidal ideations. Your thoughts do not have to become your actions. Your thoughts don't have to own, rule, or define what you do next. And that's where people get confused, is that they think that because they think they're a burden that they are, which is untrue. And if they think they're a burden that they better leave this world because those who used to love them will be better off without them. Untrue to the 10th degree. So please, if you're listening right now and you're hearing this message and you happen to be a suicidal individual, ask for help. Use four simple but effective words that I have used for the last 20 years to stay alive with chronic suicidal thinking. I need help now. And you must say it to every person you come across until someone is willing to guide you to safety.
I love that. Keep naming that. Don't act on it. Kevin, you said something so very, very key. I think a lot of times we've always thought about suicide being within the context of mental illness, like a bipolar disorder, a major depressive disorder, someone going, you know, through something very, very traumatic, or maybe something more in the thought disorder categories, schizophrenia, et cetera. However, what you're saying right now is our society is such, even with COVID being in place, we know some of the stats on suicide, it's going through the roof, particularly with young people recently too. What you're saying is it doesn't have to be a mental illness per se, it can be bullying. It can be one's self-beliefs that are so very, very negative that life becomes very, very small. The isolation we're experiencing right now with the quarantines and no school, no connection with folks, peers being, you know, stress, comparison, et cetera, all the pressures. When you talk to folks, let's say it's not within the context of a mental illness that we could diagnose, but there are other stressors or pressures, let's say situational stressors. Sure. What are some of the things you see going on in their lives that are contributing to the compounding effect that leads them into looking into that kind of that abyss of suicide? What are they going through?
You know what I'm seeing a lot? I'm seeing a lot of what I experienced in grade school. I'm seeing a lot of bullying in the high school arena.
Oh, yeah.
I'm seeing kids torturing other kids through cyberbullying, which is 60% more dangerous than physical bullying. When I was in grade school, they put me in trash can upside down and said, that's what I was, garbage, because I was part black. When I was in grade school, they punched me in the gut until my stomach was bruised, but I wouldn't show the teacher, so they never knew. When I was in grade school, they would do all kinds of things to hurt me and mess with me because I didn't look like them. And it was a big problem. That carried on to me learning how to self-loathe.
Exactly.
That turned into me being my own biggest critic.
This is so important, Kevin. This is us doing it to ourselves, almost taking the baton from others, the trauma baton that others used against us. Now we take it on ourselves. Little do we know it.
Every spiteful, hurtful, negative thing that's ever been said or done to you, you backbrain it. It stays in your brain. And when you are having a hard time later in life, you recall it and it's internalizing the pain.
That's right.
So what I used to do is I would look in the mirror. I would literally look in the mirror and I would say, I hate you. You're an idiot. You're so stupid. You're dumb. You're so ugly. And I finally learned how to reverse the negative inner critical voice and change that to be a positive inner voice. So that when the negative thoughts come forward, which they still do, I immediately shut them down with a positive voice of affirmation. And what that does is retrains the brain. So when you retrain the brain, you retrain the mind. And when you're able to do that, you can defeat any pain that comes your way. Pain is inevitable. It's coming for all of us if it hasn't already, but suffering can be optional. People have been taught by clinicians all over the world that they are suffering from this disease or this diagnosis or that diagnosis. And they all told me, they said, Kevin, you're suffering from bipolar disorder. You're suffering from asthma. You're suffering from this, suffering from that. And I adopted that narrative. But when I tell myself that I'm suffering, I then become the victim of my own story.
Exactly.
When I tell myself instead that I am living with, battling, fighting, and defeating the diagnosis, then I become the hero of my own story. And so pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, it's a choice. Choose the path of the hero. Choose the path of the person that goes, yeah, maybe I have this diagnosis, but I'm gonna defeat it one day at a time.
Yeah, I really like that. You're talking about, we all have a narrative in our head, don't we? A lot of times we're not even conscious that it's there, but we're acting on it. It's coming up. We're looking in the mirror and we're telling ourselves these things. Yeah. We also know, and you're so helpful to have that named, our traumas get locked in our neural network.
Yep.
A lot of the EMDR work talks about this, where our traumas are literally locked. And all it takes is something to trigger it, whether it be in mental illness and we're experiencing a dip or a mania going up or down, or a situational stressor that reminds us of that narrative inside. And our brain literally lights up in that trauma place. So someone says, oh, don't let it bother you. It's impossible not to be in that moment fully and to be controlled by it. However, what you're saying is a real helpful piece. We can begin to change that narrative with a narrative that says that was maybe what they said back in the day, but that was never, never a proper mirroring of who I am. Mm. And who I am is this. So your narrative to take over goes from that victim around that, well, I don't have any responsibility or any control, to that hero that says there's no way that this is true about me. Yeah. I love that encouragement.
And that I'm never going to dive in my hands because I'm always going to say, I need help now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I want people that are listening to your show, I want them to know that I'm not just coming here to be on your show to pontificate. I want to give you some resources.
I want to have some resources that they can go and look online, but I want to ask, let's stay with this theme right now. Give me some tips to get through those times.
Sure.
When one may be experiencing their thoughts, you're saying thoughts don't need to lead to actions. What do I do in that moment, though, that feels like I am so overwhelmed? What do I do?
Okay. These are things I would do in these situations. These are things I've done and that I do in these situations. So when I'm having a really bad mental health day and it's starting to get worse and worse, I'm leaning towards more depression. Maybe those suicidal thoughts are starting to creep in. My wife can see it in my eyes. She knows right away, drop and give me 50 pushups.
Okay, you know? Good.
And so I do that and I immediately—
Something to interrupt that moment.
Immediately interrupt the moment. Get a surge of endorphins and it changes the situation. I get up, I look in the mirror and I say, you are worth it, you matter, and suicide is never the solution to your problem, it is the problem.
Got it.
I flip it immediately. If that is not the answer, then I will go have a good, healthy meal and I'll go out for a walk with my wife. You know, get out of my head, get out of the situation. Make sure I'm in a physically safe place. Make sure I'm not next to any dangerous things that could harm me. Make sure there's nothing I can act on physically. And so it's a partnership with my wife to make sure that none of those things are available near me. And so that I'm physically safe and mentally safe. But those walks and those push-ups and that mirror talk, it really does help me change my perspective and change my way of thinking and allows me to get through that moment. Because it turns out that ideation is temporary.
Yes.
It's temporary. It comes and it goes. The good thing about when it comes now is I'm prepared. I'm as prepared as I'll ever be.
Yeah.
It's never going to take me because I believe in myself. I'm self-aware with my diagnosis.
Yeah.
And I know that even though I think of suicide, suicide is not the answer. And so you have to build that narrative in your system. Just like we all built for so long, the suffering narrative. If you build the narrative and the awareness narrative that suicidal ideations may come, but they don't need to lead to me acting on those ideations. They need to lead me to shouting to the mountaintops that I need help.
Yeah, I really like that. I think in our society right now, we're lacking some grit. And I think what you're encouraging is that life requires grit. We have to be hardy and we got to work at it. If we want it, we got to go get it. We got to want it.
Yeah.
And what you're saying in those moments is a couple of things that really make sense to me. I think sometimes the last place we want to be is in our head all by ourselves.
Right.
And what I like that you're saying, you mentioned your wife twice and my next steps when I'm in that moment. First of all, she sees me and she said, drop and give me 50. Or maybe sometimes you might notice it and you could drop and give yourself 50.
Yeah,
but the idea is being able to notice that moment as best we can, or have somebody around us in a significant role, catch us in that moment, have us drop, do those things to break that thought pattern, do something active, and then watch that moment pass. And I think that's such a cool set of steps, but I'm also hearing you encourage, we got to reach out to each other and ourselves reach out if we're in that place in a way that can be of help.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's the way to be. I mean, as human beings that aren't dealing with mental crises or suicidal ideations, we've got to be on the lookout for those that are.
That's really good.
As a society, it's all of our responsibility. And for those of us individuals that are going through it, we need to be able to be bold enough to tell the truth about our pain.
Kevin, tell me, as a psychologist, and for those practitioners that listen to this podcast, as we sit with folks in pain, what advice would you have for us?
You know, when you love those in pain, I think it comes down to a few things. Complete and total empathy, lack of apathy, absolute compassion, unconditional love, and regularly letting them know of the signs, symptoms, and triggers that you see within them so that they can understand that you're not just making this up, but that you can tell they're having a hard time. I think those five things can really help us benefit someone in pain.
That's really good. Kevin, you've been doing this for a while. I know we're kind of winding down on our show here, but let me ask you a couple of quick questions before we get some resources. You've been doing this work for a while. How long?
20 years.
Okay. What's the juice in your work that wakes you up every morning right now, keeps you going in this season of your life?
My fuel comes in two places, from my lovely wife who supports everything I do, and my father and my family, my mom and dad. But really it's the people that write me letters and the hundreds of thousands of people that have reached out to say that this story saved or changed their life in some way.
Love it.
You know, I don't own that. I don't believe I save lives. I believe I've given a message that as a conduit for someone to go home, do the work and change and save their own life.
I think your willingness to be as transparent and as vulnerable and as honest as you are, and to, in essence, model that for us, to show that it is okay. I think that level of integrity to do so, that willingness to be this vulnerable, allows other people to say, hey, if he can have a voice, maybe I can have one as well. And maybe my things that are going on aren't that much different than what he experienced. And maybe people can be there in the way that they were there for him. You know, as we wind down the show, what is the one thing, maybe the most important message for those contemplating suicide that you've learned directly from attempting it yourself that you want our listeners to walk away with today?
The one thing I want you to walk away with is that life is precious.
Yeah.
It's beautiful if you let it be. And if you fight your pain, you can defeat it one day at a time to be here tomorrow and every day after that.
Loving it. Yeah, loving it. Kevin, give us some resources that you highly recommend and you give folks yourself.
Sure. If you go to kevinhinesstory.com/resources, there's three pieces there for you. They're all free and they're all benefiting a lot of people right now. The first is the Art of Wellness tool guide, a PowerPoint presentation that you can teach or you can learn. You can use in trainings if you need. It's 10 steps to how I stay mentally stable. There are common sense tools to better your brain, mind, behavior, mental health, and well-being. There is a parents and teachers guide to teen mental health and suicide prevention, written by some of the best suicidologists in the field, one of the most heavily downloaded in the field. There's a guide to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/KevinHines, 486 plus videos on how to better balance your brain, mind, behavior, health, and well-being. On that YouTube series, go to the playlist section. There's a series called The Art of Wellness. It's that 10-step guide in video format, which is a much easier way to do it. 3 to 5 minutes each, easily digestible, and they're still helping people today. So let them help you.
Fantastic. Those are terrific. We're also going to put those on our page as well for folks to access. You're more than welcome to see them there as well. Kind of in closing, one of my favorite quotes as I was listening to numerous things that you've produced and written, Kevin, is you don't need to see the light at the end of the tunnel to know that it's there. And it is. You just haven't walked far enough yet. You just need someone to walk a wee bit further with you. Kevin, I want to thank you for what you're doing in walking with folks just a wee bit further by telling us your story and your message of hope and letting us all know that there are those that are out there that are willing and available to walk a wee bit further with us during times of struggle. We just need to ask. So thanks so much, Kev, for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Graham. Appreciate it.
Been awesome, man. Hey, and to those listening today, we want to thank you as always for joining us. We so appreciate it. And we'll look forward to having you join us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.